forum. The topic is, God calls us to live in relationships. Why is it so hard? We're going to resist one-liners in answer to that. The idea of a forum at Holden is to create an opportunity for people to come together and explore issues, concerns, themes, and to do so in a spirit of openness, that it's a fair place to explore and to share, to challenge, to question, and to wonder aloud. I'm Jerry Swanson. I'm going to be the moderator of tonight's forum. Part of my purpose will be to keep things moving along, and an important part of it will be to bring it to a close at 10 o'clock. And then people are welcome to stay if they would like, as long as they would like. We've organized this to put this focus on three different areas of our life in relationships. I'm going to start with work and community, and then we're going to move to family, and the last will be intimate relationships. And our three Holden people that have been thinking about this and are going to help to open up those three areas are Janet and Bert and Paula, and we're assuming that Paula will get her cash box closed at the snack bar in time to arrive for her part of it. I'm sure she will. So Janet, would you please get us started by looking at work and community?
This was a real hard one for me, but I think it's probably the easiest of the three. So, I would immediately thought of a quote by Parker Palmer, who is somebody who I trust a lot. He's done quite a bit of writing and has lived in community, in Quaker community and ecumenical community, and has done quite a bit of writing. And I won't quote him right, but he always says that whenever you're in community, there's somebody you don't like that lives there with you, and the minute they leave, somebody else comes to take their place. And I've had the opportunity to live in a number of different communities, including the Holden community, and I'm a part of a community in Minneapolis, and that tenet has lived out in my life. There's always been somebody I don't like, and somebody always replaces them. I probably am somebody that somebody doesn't like too. So there's two or three things I thought of as I was thinking about this in the context of relationship and work and community. And one of the things that's been always true for me is that I always try to work pretty hard at being honest. And I feel like that is what community is about, and that's what's important in a work situation. And I've been lucky to find community in my working situations throughout my life. And I've found that willingness to be honest, or striving to be honest, has been something that is very vulnerable, makes me very vulnerable. And it often works for me, and it strengthens the relationship, but it often doesn't work as well. And it's really hard to kind of work your hardest at being honest. It's something that you value very highly, and then it doesn't work. That's always a paradox for me, and something I really struggle with. I'd like to kind of illustrate a couple of things with just some personal stories from my work and community life. I worked at the University of Minnesota YMCA for a while, and I had a colleague there who I liked a lot, and we got along very well, and I knew I could be really honest with him most of the time. And when he'd do something that I didn't like, I knew I could fret about it for a few hours and then confront him with it, and it most of the time worked. I mean, it always strengthened our relationship. I remember one time he did a project And he coordinated a project that four staff members had worked on, two men and two women, and this kind of relates back to the feminism discussion earlier this evening. And the final product, the names that were down in the corner were the two men's names, and the two women's names were excluded. And we had all four contributed to it. So I was pretty upset about that for a long time, and finally I just called him into my office and I said, look, Keith, so you see what you've done? And he was, you know, really open to, like, wow, I didn't see it, and thanks for confronting me and all that. And it was wonderful, you know, and we hugged, and it was great. And that, you know, and it strengthened our relationship and our working relationship. Another situation was here at Holden when I was working here. There was a woman who I worked with, and we were constantly butting up against each other. And I would take the tack of being honest with her and tell her what I was feeling and what was going on, and, you know, I was feeling nervous or I was feeling upset, whatever. And it never worked. It always made it worse when I confronted her with how I was feeling. But one of the pieces that relates to that is a second point I want to make, and it has to do with power. I had more power here than she did. And so every time I confronted her, I still was in power. And even though I was being honest with her and trying to have an open relationship, every time I did that, I was more powerful than she was. And so that never worked, and so I just had to wait for her to confront me, which she never did. So we never really liked each other very much. And I still don't like meeting her when I see her. We live in opposite parts of the country, but every once in a while we run into each other, and it's real awkward. Another piece of it, I was telling Catherine that I was thinking about in the feminism thing tonight, was about fighting with each other in power, and men and women and fighting together. And I think we need to learn to fight as men and women, or have conflict. And often the person in power has, if there's a person in power, has wins the fight, no matter how you fight. And I've run up against that in work situations where my colleagues have not known how to fight with each other. And we had a conflict about conflict. And then finally, just listening is something that I find that's something I value highly and something I try to do. I'm part of this community in Minneapolis right now, and I serve as a staff person to the community. And so just before I left for out here, I had some work to do, some interviewing of community members, and found myself doing a lot of listening, and found myself having to listen to some people I didn't really like to listen to. They did things in the community that felt destructive and not helpful. But I found that when I just stopped and listened to them and tried to evoke their gift for the community, that I was better off, and they felt better about their relationship to the community, and I felt better about my relationship with those people. So if I just kind of get over my stubbornness, I guess, and listen. So I think those three points, just being honest, trying to do it, being aware of who's in power, who has more power, and listening, are some things that make relationships hard work. Maybe it's not they're hard or bad relationships, but they're hard work.
Okay. Thanks, Janet.
Sure.
And Bert.
Well, in a lot of ways, it seems like we could take what Janet said and apply it to the family. As I thought about this, I went back to my own experience, and I think in my own family, we simply didn't learn how to communicate. There was kind of an unwritten message that said, you know, you don't talk about conflict, you don't talk about feelings generally. And as I think back to, I mean, I grew up in a family of 8 kids, but I don't remember what we talked about when we had dinner or when, you know, when we were around the table. That all just seems to be kind of a haze. And certainly there was never anything that vaguely related to fighting. You know, that there was not that kind of honesty. And as you were talking, I found myself wondering if you can really love someone whom you don't trust enough to fight with. And I never learned how to fight. It was just easier to pretend that nothing was happening. And on the surface, it looked like things were fine. But it was just all sort of not being dealt with. So, I think basically what I was taught about communication as I grew up is that it wasn't safe to trust my own feelings. And when you can't trust your own feelings, even within your own family, then it makes it that much harder to go out to people who aren't even family and trust your feelings with them. I think another thing that happened in my own family is that there was a lot of caretaking in the sense of, you know, we were always kind of worried about how the other person was going to react. And so what we all did is kind of walk on eggshells so that nobody would get hurt. And in the process of walking on all those eggshells, again, it was like no real communication happened. As I was thinking today about all of this, I remembered the title of a book by Terry Cole Whitaker, What You Think of Me Is None of My Business. But I didn't learn that at all as I was growing up. What other people thought of me was absolutely crucial. And, you know, what the neighbors thought of us as a family was absolutely crucial. And a few years ago, I read a book called Celebrating Yourself. And one of the chapters in that book deals with the injunctions that we receive as we're growing up. Injunctions being messages that were never given in so many words, but which still very clearly came across. And I think that might be an interesting thing for us to talk about later this evening. What were some of the injunctions that each of us received about communication from our family of origin? That's all I want to say.
Okay, thank you, Bert. Paul?
Well, I was contemplating today on what I wanted to say tonight. I struggled between taking it two ways, and the fact that one of the things that I have finally in my life been able to to successfully do, and that's have some very intimate, wonderful friendships with people of the opposite sex. And I find that to be such a immense celebration for me. And then also of taking it the other direction and having an intimate relationship with one person that goes to a really deep level. And there's so many aspects of both issues that are the same. And then one of them, again, goes clear back to that integrity of being absolutely honest with the other person, but more important, I think, is being honest with myself. What do I feel? Why am I acting this way? Gosh, I'm feeling irritated. Why am I irritated? Is it something within me? Is it really a fear on my part? Or is it something this other person is doing? And it's just that whole issue of trust and allowing that person to be a friend without suspecting any ulterior motives that they're going to use me or I'm going to use them. I think one of the hardest lessons I've learned in life is if I need another person for whatever the reason, then there is not integrity in the relationship because there is not equality. If I'm needing that person, then that person has power over me. Or at the same time, if that person is coming to me to fulfill a part of their being as whatever, as I grew up back in the 60s and earlier stuff, I think some of the women that haven't been through the women's liberation can remember that we were brought up to be the frosting in a marriage that we filled in and made, we were Mrs. somebody, and that we completed this other person or that other person completed us. And there was that need. And I think that really being that equality in a relationship, whether it's between a lifetime partnership that is going to be on an intimate level or friendships across the board. And I think a lot of my intimate relationships now with my friends of the opposite sex and of the same sex is finally going beyond homophobia and heterophobia. As much as some people have homophobia that of someone that's gay or lesbian and they're not sure whether they should have a friendship with them because, gosh, what does that mean? But also of having the people of the opposite sex having a friendship, an intimate friendship. I call it heterophobia, of being able to have a real solid friendship without sexual inclinations that will lead to places where you really don't want to go. And being able to, if those things come up, those issues come up, to be very, very frank about them and talk them out, getting past them. And then it's back to honesty and integrity. I think that's the main recipe in any relationship, whether it's with God, because God already knows our heart. We can't, there's nothing that gets past God. We're just kidding ourselves if we're not being totally honest. And in doing that, we're not kidding anybody but ourselves. So, I guess that's my message, that's my philosophy and what I try to live by.
Okay, thank you, Paula, Janet, Bert. An open forum now to find the the openings or the starting places for where our time together might carry us. Who would like to? Yeah.
Yeah, Bert, I have a question. Did the patterns that you learned in your family make you feel like you had a problem getting close to other people? And if that's what you found to be true, how did you then learn to be close to other people?
Could you speak up a little bit more?
Yeah. I was asking Bert if the patterns that he learned in his family, the denial of certain feelings, the absence of conflict and the honesty, if that prevented him from feeling close to those in his family, and if that carried over to other friendships, and if so, how he's dealt with that.
One thing that comes to mind, when I was a freshman in college, I had a room on the third floor of a dormitory right next to the elevator, and what I did for my freshman year was go from my room into the elevator, to the classroom, to the library, to the cafeteria, to the elevator, to my room. And by the end of my freshman year, I was beginning to get to know some of the people who lived down the hall from me. So yeah, it affected me growing up in the family I did. But I think what eventually happened is that I began taking some risks and realizing that I could indeed share feelings with people. And I'm still, this may sound strange, I'm still much more comfortable one-on-one than I am in a group. it's a gradual process of realizing that people can indeed be trusted. Taking that risk to do so.
Yeah. Have you had any success taking these issues up with your family members?
I'm very isolated from my family in lots of ways. I grew up in the Midwest, and most of my family is still back there. And I've been in the Northwest for about 15 years. So there's not any really solid communications with family per se. But one of the good things that I experienced this morning in your life exam, Janet, was that one about, you know, do you have friends that mm-hmm. you feel supported by? And yeah, please.
Well, I'd like to hear you talk more about not needing people. I've read that before. I haven't decided whether I agree with that or not. I've tried so hard all my life not to need people, not to need things, and come to find out recently you do need conversations seem more real, friendships seem more real. And I don't know if I agree with that or not.
I think the fine line, there's... I think there's a line there. Maybe it's a gray area, but of defining dependency versus interdependency, or of a dependency as an addiction need of this person. I can't be happy without this person. This person is filling an area of my life that I need to be able to fulfill myself. I'm trying to think of an example in my life. At one point, I was in a relationship that, I was in this relationship that I realized after I was out of it, of course you never know you're in swamp water until you go back and look, that When you get out, you got leeches all over you.
That's pretty drastic.
This person needed me. I was working for them. I was also seeing this person, how I'd gotten involved in the business was that I was dating the person and we came up with this great idea to have a business, got incorporated in the business, and it got really tangled. And I knew that I was needed to in the business, but that I was helping this person to become successful, not realizing at the time that I was giving this person all my energy to become successful, when this energy I really could have been developing my own success. But I needed that other person to be successful because I was living basically vicariously through them. I needed that person to feel alive, to be whole. I didn't feel that I could be a complete person without a relationship. This person was a relationship. It's kind of a bad relationship is better than no relationship at all. And I really felt that as I look back on it, that I was in a pretty addictive type mode of needing that person. And I was lucky enough, I had a good friend that I was really not wanting to go to work anymore. I hated the place. And they said, well, why are you going then? I said, well, they need me. And this person said, are you sure you've got that right? And I realized that I was needing them, that I was putting all my energy into that business and that person, when I was needing it to be a complete person. And that, I don't think it's healthy. I don't know if I answered that very well or not.
Thanks. Carrie, does it help to think in terms of not needing people, not at all meaning not having people in your life? That's not what it's saying at all. I mean, certainly, you know, as you said, people in friendships and conversations and just sharing a sunset, that makes a difference. But it's that difference between saying, I'm not complete until there's another person in my life. Is that, Paula?
No, that's
where you're headed?
Because then you're not reaching each other on equality, because you're dependent upon that other person.
Yeah.
Rather than being able to meet on equal ground.
Jennifer James, who is a sort of pop psychologist in Seattle and writes a weekly column for the Seattle Times, once mentioned that, you know, it was just shortly after she had been working in her garden one day and finally just said to herself, you know, I really don't need another person to make me complete, that she met her present husband. And you know, I think that's wonderful to be able to get to that point of saying, I am complete by myself, and it would be nice to share that with someone else. But as opposed to saying, I need someone else before I'm complete.
I think there's something somewhat real that we need to confront in experiencing people. You know, I think if I felt complete by myself and shared that completeness with someone and they died, I would need to grieve a loss that was a part of my wholeness. I mean, if there is a part of what made me whole, because I think we are a part of all of our relationships. I mean, that's a part of making us whole, is having healthy relationships. So I think there's a process that, I mean, we can't idealize and say, well, when that happens, then I still am whole. I mean, we still may be whole, but we need to confront the grieving and the, I mean, in any relationship that, and, you know, that there's a loss that, I mean, I don't know, I think I understand exactly what you're saying, but I think there's other parts that are important.
Yes, Bonnie.
I can't help but remember years ago a poster that I think I even had for a while. It says, you have to be you and I have to be me before we can be us. Mm-hmm. And I think that this covers it. And this question that came from back here also reminded me of a statement I read by, and I always get the name wrong, but Bruce Gowen. And he writes on love and loving. And he says over and over again in his books that in loving, that you must give for the joy that it gives yourself, expecting nothing in return, and that way anything that you get back in return is a pleasant surprise, but that love has to be a giving without that expectation of receiving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that same light that's kind of freeing ourselves from that dependency.
Simone Weil writes an essay on friendship, and it's always had a profound effect on me, and she talks about friendships or relationships in equality because of that, going into a friendship with anything but equality gives one person or the other power over, and which leaves room for some type of manipulation. A lot of times so unconscious, but that you're, by any kind of looking to that other person for whatever it is, you are giving away the power of being a whole human being, and whether that other person wants it or not. And if it's not, if you're giving it, in my particular case, I gave it to a person that wasn't any healthier than I was and took advantage of it. I don't think he did it consciously, but we got into a very, very lopsided relationship because of my looking for that other, going into it with a need. The whole thing of equality in a friendship, that is not a true friendship unless there is equality, but across the board equality, no power over either way.
Yes.
There's things that Bert and Janet and Paul have all said here that I can plug into, you know, looking at my own life. I don't know if everyone here is basically in the same boat I find myself in, but what I hear Paul, I think, talking about is what I would consider to be codependency, which is something I've had to struggle with in my past. And I see some books over in the bookstore on that. I hear Janet talking about a situation where that I find myself in supervising people in my job, and I guess just recently I realized, you know, why aren't these people, I mean, these are people that I used to work with on the same level, and now I'm supervising these same people. You know, why isn't my relationship with these people, it seems to have changed somewhere along the way. And I realized, well, here I am empowered. I mean, I still consider that I'm the same person and still someone that they can come to talk to if there's a problem, or if they don't think they're being treated fairly or, you know, inequitably in some way. But at the same time, then I look at my relationship with my boss, and there's things I won't say to my boss because, well, quite honestly, I don't trust my boss. So, you know, I can understand how those kinds of situations arise. But I guess the thing I plug into the most is what Bert's saying over here with the situation with his family. I am gay, and I have done everything I can do, I think, as far as I know, to be open and honest with my family about who I am. But I have two sisters who are very much fundamentalist, and they cannot accept the fact that I'm gay, that that's the way I am, that that's the way I'm always going to be. And we've come to kind of an impasse in communicating, and I guess I'm still in a quandary as to where I go in relationship with these two sisters of mine, who I still care about, and I'm sure they still care about me. But I'm at a point where I don't know what more I can do to facilitate communication and understanding. I mean, I know who I am, and I know where I am, and I've gone through a long struggle to get where I am. And then they're telling me, on the other hand, that they know better than I know myself, and that they can't accept me the way I am. I mean, we still talk to each other, but I can't feel the closeness to these people that I used to feel and would like to be able to feel again, and I don't know how to get beyond that.
Maybe that's where Jennifer's grieving comes in. And realizing perhaps also that, you know, it's not your responsibility to help them understand, in the sense that you can't make them understand. It's got to come from them. You can facilitate it, but, you know, ultimately they're the ones who have to decide that they want to be open to you.
Well, that's true, and I agree with that. I guess my ongoing feeling is that I would like to have the wisdom to be able to see a way to get beyond that situation.
There's the analogy isn't that significant, but just this woman I worked with, the one that I don't like to run into anymore, I kind of have to let it go. And it's easy to let it go because I don't see her very often, but I do see her once in a while, and kind of have to let it go, and that's really hard for me. I like to be in control of my life. I like to know how I'm going to respond and how somebody else is going to respond if I can, but I can't. But that letting go stuff is the same thing as what Jennifer said about loss and grief. I agree with what Bert said.
I guess that's where I am too. I like to be in control and know that I know the best way to do things.
Right.
Can find a way around any obstacle.
You can do your best and it doesn't always work.
I think I get back into this poster that I remember from years and years ago about you have to be you and I have to be me before it can be us. And you have to be you. It sounds like you have come to terms with who you are and you are happy with who you are, and that is who you are. And your sisters are who they are with their beliefs. And if they can't respect your right to be an individual, to have your own existence and identity, then they are not being honest in the relationship either. And they have to, you know, you've made your statement, you've said this is who I am, and I'm happy here. And they have to say, well, I'm not happy with that. And you have to say, well, I respect what you say, but you also need to respect what I say. And that has to happen before you can have a relationship where you are us, where you are family. And if, you know, if they're not ready for that, then you just need, I think, to ride along as best you can until, you know, they fall into that spot. And just know that that's part of the price you made for that transition, I think. It would be interested, Bertie, you have 6 siblings, 7. How did they come out as adults in terms of communicating?
How long do you want to stay here?
Are they also the ones that were happy in a room next to the elevator?
Well, no, I don't know how it happens that 7 to 8 children, you know, who all grew up in the same family end up being different people, but that's also the miracle of human existence. You know, maybe why I related the way I did is that I was the only male in that family. And I was second youngest, and so, you know, from early on, I think I created my own world. So, this isn't the time to talk about how my 7 sisters relate.
I come from a family of 6. The youngest one was the only boy. I can appreciate some of where you're coming from.
Yes.
I've got a question regarding the relationship, the marriage relationship. Does it have to be compatible? It seems as though I hear that everything has to be compatible. Now, my good wife and I have been married 45 years, and I think I can say that not always have things been compatible. But we have had certain basic goals that we both have in mind that we had when we got married. These, in a sense, are the motivating forces that override many other things. And it seems to me that in some cases, and probably, and I'm kind of asking questions here, what is the dominating force that holds people together? Is it something, is it only that within them, or is there something greater than what's within me, us, that is a goal that we both strive for and work for? I'm just kind of lost in this thing, and maybe I don't know why we survived 45 years.
I kind of heard the answer in your question, in that it's something greater.
But I've been hearing here tonight that it has to be complete compatibility, that that's a way to survival, that that's a way to, that that's the ultimate.
I don't think it's compatibility.
We've said that. Janet very clearly talked about fighting, and I think, you know, all of us have been saying in one form or another that real communication means that you are honest, and that means sharing both negative and positive feelings.
I think it's the term I like now is conflict resolution. It's not even compromising, as it is incorporating both needs or both individuals without always a lopsided, submissive and dominant relationship, but of the ability to work in incorporation with each other. It's pretty idealistic, I agree. I haven't been successful yet. I'm working on it.
The word I heard more was equality and not compatibility, in that you're at the same level with the other person. You don't feel like they're any better than you are, or you don't feel like you're any worse than they are. And it has nothing to do with, I don't think it has anything to do with education or looks or personality. It's just like sometimes you meet people and you know that you just feel equal to them and that you can fight with them and you can get mad and you can be happy, and but you're always on the same level with them, and I think in that you retain who you are. And I guess that's what I would call it.
Yeah, I guess the word I've kind of searched for is our own personal self-worth, and that the other person also has their own self-worth, but also as much as I value myself, I value you, and I trust that you value me also as much as you value yourself. I know my parents were married 50-some years, and it was really a traditional marriage. Anything inside the walls was my mom's domain. Everything outside the walls was my dad's domain. And yet, I always felt that they really valued each other. And I think that's that compatibility that you're talking about is the valuing of another human being as much. I think Christ taught us to love your neighbor as yourself. We always forget about as yourself. We always think that I love your neighbor more than myself. And it's that just valuing of human life, of human beings.
I think that we, one of the things we've talked about here is that identity. Because that in a close relationship, everybody needs to maintain their own identity, their own feeling of self. And that when you, in a marriage, what you've got in a marriage is you've got two people who have their identity and are compatible insofar as they can share the same mind space. They can, kind of an abstract thing here that's not quite pulled together in my mind, but in a fight, can they know that their values and their thinking and a lot of their things are close enough that they can reach compromises, you know, in their, I guess, conflict resolution, so you don't necessarily compromise, but that they can resolve these things in some way. So they have to stay as two individuals with the right to their own existence. And that what happens in marriage in this overlap space is that they have some kind of an ability for a shared life space.
You articulate that very well.
I wonder if there are other sorts of questions or openings that people would like to make. We're moving into the last 10 minutes of our time. Gretchen?
Yeah, we've been married for a year now, and I was talking to someone, he's been married three times, and he said, "So, is this your first time around?" And it kind of startled me. Well, yeah, it is. I hope it's the only time. But I'm interested in hearing comments about how we approach marriage anymore, if it's really something to try for a few years. We've been bombarded with divorce rates this whole year, you know, hearing how it's creeping up past 50% in our country now. And I'd love to hear some other ideas, especially from older people, how they see and feel with that.
What was the question?
Do you want to just repeat that a little?
I'm wondering how especially older people see the changing divorce rate and how they react to it.
Well, some of us older people are divorced, sadly to say. And it's something that happens to us, maybe not because we want it to happen. Certainly the mutual respect that you have for each other is beautiful. But it also means that two people can't change very much in that relationship, that you have to stay sort of true to that. And when one partner changes a lot, sometimes it means they have to leave that relationship. And divorce is part of our life, and some of us are victims of it, and we learn to live with it. And we grow, and but it would be wonderful if it didn't ever have to happen.
Thank you for sharing that.
Well, I think it makes a difference where your relationship is with the Lord. And what your spiritual values are when you start off, and the amount of commitment. The person who has gone through three marriages and asked you that didn't have a whole lot of commitment somewhere down the line.
I think, I don't know if you missed off path, but in terms of divorce, the old traditional marriage where the woman was the frosting, she lost a lot of her identity and kind of gave herself into that marriage. And I think today's marriages, where there's more equality in each person's right to be an individual, I think that we maybe tend to see more growing in different directions. And if those directions just can't parallel, then we wind up in divorce situations. And I really think that the emphasis on our right to an existence of our own as women in a marriage situation is part of what causes the increased divorce rate over what we saw, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
I think, though, that the feminist movement has caused many of us women to be much more militant and lacking in finesse and negotiative powers. And there's many excellent books out if you're trying to get your point across or getting your spouse to listen up. Go at it as though you were the chairman of the board and you had a whole bunch of people that you wanted to negotiate to a yes. Without a no win-lose situation. There's a lot of excellent books on it, and a lot can be gained. You don't have to bludgeon somebody to death with your opinions and your values, and this is me, and so there it is, you know. You know, you don't need to scream it out. You can, in love, in the love of Christ, share the new us, the new... And I didn't do such a swift job of doing it myself, so this is, you know, hindsight is 20/20. I was into my bludgeoning, I'm a woman, and this is me, and if I rub your back, you're going to rub mine and rub it good. There's other ways to get the message across, and I think that both parties, my being a woman, I only come from that side of the point of view, but I'm certain it would be just as applicable on the other side, that if we negotiated with each other, if we prayed fervently before we presented an idea, if we sought the Lord's guidance, and the Lord can do marvelous things. Read in there the great blessings that are going to be ours if we but ask. Ask and you shall be given if it's a righteous prayer. Amen. I was in church for years. Did I ask the Lord? Not as often as I should have.
Well, I guess I can respond to that question, too, about divorce. I suppose every marriage is potentially subject to divorce because there are stresses and strains in life. It has happened in my family. My sister went through this, so I know something about it. And again, looking at this matter of our marriage of 45 years, I think both of us have tried to be fair and recognize the other person as a person. We both entered into a marriage. We're both, whatever we were when we got married, we're different now, because my wife has changed me and I have changed her. We've grown together. I suppose if there is a situation where one or the other is not going to give and grow, it'll eventually end up in an irresolvable conflict. But I suppose this comes down to the matter of the individuals recognizing this and having some basic goals and objectives that are so strong that they're part of us, that overrides some of these other problems. I can't put the things into words, but...
I think you're doing a great job. You're saying exactly what Janet said this morning in her life exam thing, that, you know, if you start with a mission, then you've got something to fall back on, and it sounds like that's what you've done. I mean, you started with some goals and some ideas of...
Maybe that's what I was meditating on this morning when I was hiking. Sorry I missed your talk.
One thing that I think Jennifer's, looks like Jennifer's gone now, but her point about loss and grief, I think we don't have the right kind of language to use. I lose a part of myself when someone dies, or I move away from a community. There's a piece of me that's gone, and so we call that our wholeness, and I don't think we have the right kind of language to deal with that with, because I rankle at what, you know, wait a minute, I'm a whole person without another person or another piece of my life. But yet, I'm sad when someone's gone or a piece of my life has ended. So I struggle with the language thing there.
I agree with you. My mother used to have a great way of having gone through a number of deaths in the family and a couple divorces amongst her children and stuff. She always described her heart as a house of rooms, and each new person that came into her life was another room on her house. And as a child, if we had a couple children, young deaths in our family, and it would just be a matter of closing the door and not entering that room as often. The room never left, it never changed size, always loved that child, but you just didn't get to live in that room or visit that room anymore. And so it's not a piece of her gone, it's just, I agree with you. I think we need some new words in our language.
That's right. Jackie?
I'm baffled by relationships.
What's new?
I don't have any, you know, responses to some of the questions, but I certainly have more questions. I think the start of the, or the first part of the title, God calls or asks us to be in relationship, is sort of one baffling part of it. I think we're really relational creatures. I mean, you can just kind of look at the, just observing human behavior and see how much we kind of like to be together. And I think for all of us, sometimes that is just an extremely bittersweet experience. And I also, I tend to believe that we really learn how to do relationships in the family that we grow up in, or what resembles somewhat of our family, and I think that's our first sort of school for learning how to do it. And whatever circumstances go on in that family, some of us learn it really in a skewery kind of way, and others of us probably learn it a little better, I don't know. But I'm also always curious about the gender differences in terms of relating. And some of the work being done on the differences in moral development between men and women, and how women tend to enter relationships with more the fear of being abandoned, and men the fear of being engulfed or taken over. And I'm always kind of wondering what part that plays in terms of how we start, you know, to relate to each other. And I think that's shed a lot of light on it for me, but I'm curious how other people see that as well.
And that can be a part of our ongoing conversation. And part of the joy of being at Holden is that we don't get far from each other so that we can continue it. I'd like to thank Janet and Paul and Bert and all of you for being present and attentive to some very real and searching kind of openings. And I'd like to just, let's give ourselves all a